And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness, if you hear Dean Haglund's fingers flying across a keyboard somewhere in Detroit, Michigan, it's because he's dialing up the latest news and information for your edification on this brand new episode. How are you, Dean?
I'm doing very well, though I think it's what we call allergy season here, though I wasn't aware that I'm into allergies. But all of a sudden, it's allergy season.
But you were downright sick. I was going to say you sound so much better. You were downright sick last week.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. The Michigan killer cold that's out here taking everybody by storm is luckily on the wane, as they say. So I don't know if I'm on the tail end of the cold or on the front end of an allergy that I'm not normally susceptible to. So there might be some plant here that may be irritating my sinuses that I don't know.
Now,
I'll have to research.
Now, ever since the advent of Taken by Storm became a thing, and I don't know the origin of it, honestly, off the top of my head, because I was about to say, then what do you say when someone literally is swept away by a storm? Like, you can't use it anymore because people will just think, oh, he's just being, you know, metaphorical.
Right.
But is that where we get taken by storm, or is it like we're storming the castle?
I gotta think it's from the sailor days of like, oh, I was taken by storm to a deserted island, or it's taken by storm. So you got there very quickly, particularly if you have full sails in a storm. I would think your schooner, man of war ship would go very fast in a storm at full sail. So
I got into a conversation, I don't even remember with whom, but there was the age old conversation of, you know, what do rocket scientists compare their work to? Right. You know, like, hey, this isn't rocket science, Dean.
Right.
You know? But rocket scientists would have to say, right, this isn't rocket science. Oh, wait. Oh, no, that's exactly what it is.
But, well, in fact, NASA sells T-shirts that say that very thing.
Right.
So, not rocket science, parentheses. Oh, yes, it is.
Right. So that's an age old joke. But somebody brought this up and said, what do they say? You know, and I immediately hit them with modern dance.
It's not modern dance.
This isn't modern dance, Jim. It's rocket science. Wait. Yeah.
Yes, so, it is.
Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, it could be modern dance.
Hey, I think where we left things last week, we were talking about some TV. I was talking about the horrible, apparently the horrible treatment and the misleading of director Andre Arnold on Big Little Lies Season 2. But the stage was set. I was fascinated by, intrigued by learning what Dean Haglund is watching now. What TV shows are you watching?
Oh, my gosh. Let's begin. I just binge-watched my friend Edie Patterson in The Righteous Gemstones on HBO. This is a Danny McBride comedy that he created and wrote.
So interesting that you brought this up. So Edie Patterson, great. And you binged watch it. Dear God, how did you pull off this trick? Look, I love Danny McBride.
Yeah.
Vice Principals, fantastic.
Yeah.
This show, what's the opposite of fantastic? Tortured?
Well,
tortured might be the word for it.
It is not necessarily funny. It's really actually kind of dark, shockingly dark. And to say it's a dark comedy is only to say there's some funny lines in it. But everybody's character flaws are so...
Okay, but you're just, you could just be describing Vice Principals, because that was Vice Principals. And Edie Patterson, unbelievably funny in Vice Principals. The thing is, though, that he took his approach with Vice Principals and he hit a target that had not been done.
Right.
And all he's really done here is it feels like, let's make a movie about show business. Let's make a show about show business. It's already over the top. What made Vice Principals so funny was taking such a small, mundane aspect of life, the high school vice principal, and elevating it to the nth degree. Now you're taking something that is already elevated and is artificial and elevating it to the nth degree.
Yeah, but they're not elevating it, though. I think they're bringing it back to a dark, dark grounding of real deep human flaws.
That everybody sees when they look at these people already. You don't think? This is a 5-minute sketch stretched out over many, many episodes, and it's what we expect when we look at these people.
Yeah.
In real life.
But what's funny about it is, I think, the character dynamics. So there's some funny lines, per se, and funny situations. There's a blackmail ongoing overarching plot. A blackmail plot that's kind of funny, and group dynamics. But ultimately, you're correct in your assessment of it's showbiz. It's already targeted, and it's the same actual formula as Vice Principals.
Yeah, so, although I said in episode, I guess, is it episode one where the the blackmail plot gets introduced. I said, it's like Vice Principals if Vice Principals was starting with the final episode of season one, where now we're just going to be plot driven.
And that's the thing. It's plot driven.
Which is why you were able to binge watch it, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've talked about how binge watching shows being bingeable leads to worse shows. And it's fascinating because the network most responsible for everybody binge watching things, right? Netflix is now discontinuing releasing shows all at one time.
Right. Yeah, they're staggering it out, which is good, I think, because you realize that there's so many platforms, and with Apple TV coming out, that if you are binge watching, you're just spending a day on a platform, as opposed to having them return again and again.
Yeah, so, and you're not going to watch other things because next episode starts in 17 seconds. as opposed to when it's done now, how about we recommend you watch these things?
Yeah, for people who watch this, they also watch that, you know. So it seems that what everybody's doing now on the new streamings is going back to the model that the networks always had in the first place. How do you keep eyeballs coming back week after week? You show a weekly show and with, you know, characters you love, stories that are great, plots, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Characters that you love, stories that are great, plots that are blah, blah, blah. That's the description of our shows that are available only on the Chill Pack Hollywood app.
That's right. Yeah. I don't want to be technical, but that's exactly right.
I don't know where, I couldn't remember where one of the ads some show seemed interesting enough, but I couldn't remember where it was. Like, I know it was an Apple Plus, but it was another new streaming service. Right. And so I just found myself saying to somebody that it was on my eye surgeon's app. Like, it's only available. Really? Yeah, they're getting into television production now.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious.
And the name of the show is The Eyes Have It. All right. That's fascinating that you were watching the Righteous Gem shows. You know, I was watching it or trying to watch all of it at the same time that I was trying to dig into that Kirsten Dunst show that I just talked about last week on Becoming a God in Central Florida. There are some similarities to this.
Right.
On Becoming a God targets the whole MLM, get rich schemes.
Yes.
And it does some things very well. She's terrific, that Kirsten Dunst. I think last week I called her one of the defining actresses of our generation.
And I think you did.
And I wish that, I really wish that it was, I don't know if I wish it was Kirsten Dunst or her character making the show, but I do wish it had the focus on that character and of that character, the show. Because it's a bit, it's not scattershot, the right word, but the focus is spread around a little too much, and with the exception of one other character, it's not recognizably real. You know, you want to take the real and then push it with your tone and with your approach, right? But the characters need to start real. And if they don't, and only some of them do, then you have kind of an odd tension that can't really hold the tone. And as you've talked about a lot of times with these kind of comedic approaches, these satirical approaches, if you lose the tone, it's really hard or impossible to get it back.
Yeah, exactly. Because your tone is considered wildly uneven. And what may appeal to one demographic in tone, then the next show is off. Now you've alienated two prospective audience groups, and you are now wrestling. You have counter marketing issues.
Right. and after 50, men often experience counter marketing issues. But there's a pill for that. And it's interesting, though, because we do live at a time where these shows get picked up. And both of these shows we're talking about are HBO and Showtime.
Right.
They're not even going to, they might get canceled after a first season, not picked up for a second season. But the whole first season is going to be available. There's no question about that. And when you're trying something like this, it isn't maybe like the benefit of the doubt you get with other kinds of shows where it's all right. Like, this is pretty good. We'll find it. We're finding it.
Right.
It's very hard to find it several episodes in on a series that's built on this kind of satire.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And, as we know, comedy and satire, very difficult to do, requires a laser-like focus, and also unearthing something that's not done before. Vice Principals is a great example of that. So has multi-level marketing been made fun of before? Not necessarily, but it's a scammy thing in the first place. So,
so here's my thought about maybe both of these shows to a degree is, where their focus lies. Danny McBride so understands the South, a southern United States that doesn't get depicted very often. And I wanted more of that from him. I wanted him to pick something that people don't know about, and don't, right, you know, that people don't show. But there's such a fascination with the evangelists and the televangelists. There's such a fascination with it, and there have been so many depictions before. And if he was drawn to that milieu, wouldn't it have been fascinating? This is me now criticizing the show for what it's not, but I did criticize it for what it is, so I feel I'm allowed to make one suggestion. Wouldn't it have been fascinating to tell this show through the point of view of peripheral characters to this world? The stage managers or the gift shop employees or the, you know, because they do, they're these cottage industries. They employ a lot of people.
Right.
And I think there's a lot, you know, you once said, and then they end up doing it, but you were saying about how I think there were, you know, short films or fan films about Star Wars, and you were talking about how the for the longest time, the movie you wanted to see was the one about the disgruntled stormtrooper.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's sort of that that famous Eddie Izzard bit about the cafeteria worker serving Darth Vader in the middle of the Death Star, not realizing the Death Star is a giant floating planet. And that he's always just working inside the cafeteria, deep inside the Death Star. It's a very funny bit. You can look it up. I think they even did a little Lego animation to Eddie Izzard's bit.
Well, it's the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead approach, isn't it? Let's take these two characters, these minor characters that are so minor that often in condensed productions, they get cut out.
Yeah.
And let's tell the entire story from their point of view. And of course, in great writing, in great storytelling, you get the sense that you could have followed any character and seen the story from their point of view, and it still would have been fascinating. And
right.
So wouldn't that be, you know, the name of the show wasn't Principles. We've seen that. It wasn't focusing on the high school students. We've seen that. It was focusing on the rugged adventure of vice principals. I mean, and so here, what would the equivalent be? I don't know, but I think that there's lots of, a lot of terrain.
The secondary characters of the rock band, I think, would have been funny too. A Christian rock band that working for a giant televangel, because they're sort of like, they're all kind of idiots, the way Danny McBride writes them. And that would have been, I would have watched that probably even more. But yeah, you're right. You know?
It's again, that's criticizing it for what it's not. And I say it though with love, because again, Danny McBride knows this terrain, observes this terrain, and has proven that he can express it in a way that's so fresh and different from everybody else. And this approach was, I mean, it was just disappointing to me, because I felt like, okay, Danny McBride, now do what you do, but take an approach everyone would take.
Right, right, yeah.
So,
there you go.
All right.
What else have you, what are you watching? Did we get there?
Well, I just started watching, you know, the final season of The Good Place that premiered.
And
a show I got into because of you, because of a car ride from LAX to the Eastern Columbia building.
Right.
And I became a huge Fast fan, and the final season has begun. So that's terribly exciting. And just so smart, that show. Gosh darn it.
Yes. Yes. It's got philosophical aspirations to it, for sure.
I've also almost completed the long-awaited season 3 of Documentary Now.
Oh, yeah.
And
how's that holding up?
Well, it's been a fascinating season because although Fred Armisen does appear in several of the episodes, you know, it was always a Seth Meyers, Bill Hader, Fred Armisen collaboration. But Bill Hader was unavailable because he was doing season two of Barry. And so they decided on a slightly different approach. And there's two episodes that at the outset, three episodes right off the top that have neither Bill Hader nor Fred Armisen involved at all.
Wow. It's all, any big names?
It's all guest stars. And, and as a result, it really kind of finalized what the approach had been evolving into. I.e., parodies of actual documentaries that aren't so much parodies as, again, explorations of slightly different things that the original documentary filmmaker may have thought was B material, and rather than the A material. So the first two-parter was a show called Batshit Valley. And it's about a it's based on a Netflix documentary from earlier this decade, a 5-episode Netflix documentary about a commune, and the guest stars include Owen Wilson and Michael Keaton, for crying out loud. And it's very funny, though. If anything, it hews too closely to the original. It's like almost too much like the original, and you go, okay, well, yeah, they've recreated this well. But that's the danger with where they've been heading, and it's the right way to go, which is instead of parodying these things, use these things to, you know, remember when Carl Rove, I Love You, when somebody would call it a mockumentary, and I would say it wasn't, because we're not mocking documentaries at all. We're using a documentary approach to elucidate something. And it's much like how the evolution of Portlandia was so pleasing, that as they went on, there was less and less overt parody, and just more and more love and admiration that was expressed.
They started falling in love with the characters that originally were mocks of stereotypes.
And so what begins as a series built on sketch comedy of Bill Hader and Fred Armisen, by the time you get to Juan Loves Chicken and Rice, the parody of Euro Dreams of Sushi, is this winking kind of under the surface parody that overtly could be taken as a real documentary. And that was spectacular. That's why Juan Loves Chicken and Rice is one of the great episodes of television ever created. And there are two of this season that are equal to it, if don't surpass it. And one is a documentary called Original Cast Album Co-op. And this is a parody based on the 1970 D.A. Pennebaker documentary about a marathon recording session for Stephen Sondheim's musical Company. The documentary was called Original Cast Album Company. And that Broadway show closed as soon as it opened. Everybody thought, oh, well, this will be a big hit. It's Stephen Sondheim. So we've got to create, let's get the cast album produced as quickly as possible so that we can sell it during the show's long run. And they find out while they're recording the album that the show has been closed. And so this is Original Cast Album Co-op. A musical, Sondheim musical, set in a co-op with John Mulaney playing the Sondheim character. And I find out that John Mulaney has written many of the episodes of Documentary Now through the seasons, and he wrote this and all the songs. And it is absolutely fantastic. It's hilarious, yes, and no more ridiculous than the original cast album Company was. And how amazing that they released this parody of D.A. Pennebaker right at the time when D.A. Pennebaker dies.
Yeah, that's amazing too.
Coincidence?
So I
sense a conspiracy, but
I've never seen that documentary about Company. That sounds really good, actually.
And you don't need to really be able to. You could see it in whatever order you want. you could watch Juan Loves Chicken and Rice, for example, and before you ever saw Euro Dreams of Sushi, which is the order that I saw it, and and both are lovely. And I'm not sure that that would have always been the case through that show, but with this approach, where you really are like not so much you're not mocking or making fun of the original. You're using the original to explore some idea that you saw within it, and or that it inspired you. No, you know, it's kind of more akin to, oh, I see your High Noon and I raise you Rio Bravo. It's kind of that sort of approach to it. Anyway, this co-op, I could go on and on about it, but it takes one little exchange that Sondheim has teaching the pronunciation of the word booby to a performer, and it kind of makes that, instead of a throwaway, like the most important thing. And so it's that shift in focus more than anything that is what this show's about now. Anyway, the other one that is utter perfection this season stars Cate Blanchett as the artist. I can't remember what the character's name is in the show, but it's the name of the episode is Waiting for the Artist, and it's a parody of Marina Abramovich, The Artist Is Present. Do you remember that documentary about the artist's work, where the artist is sitting there in the gallery the whole time and you sit in a chair opposite her and just stare at her in the retrospective of her work? Anyway, it's a parody of that. It's a retrospective of the artist named Isabella Barta. And it's fantastic. Again, it could be a documentary of an artist named Isabella Barta.
Fantastic. I now want to see all these.
Yeah, you absolutely, those two that I mentioned, I mean, the one with the artist, how could you not? And Cate Blanchett, God bless her, you know, she's not taking this as some, you know, lark, some vacation from acting. No, she's, you hired Cate Blanchett, you're getting Cate Blanchett.
Right. So
this is as important a work as any art film she's ever done.
Fantastic. Oh,
I mean, her, you know, to her, in terms of her, the integrity that she's bringing to it. I don't mean,
right.
I'm not saying that her art films aren't important. God bless. No. And finally, Dean, I watched the pilot of a show called Evil.
Oh yeah! Now that everybody on the X-File groups are saying this is the torchbearer of the X-Files.
It is, and that's what Lily said. And but much like the X-Files, it is probably a show, at least in one episode, if you can say this. But it does remind me of the experience of watching that pilot of The X-Files so many years ago. John Giroudo coming over to my house in Cupertino, my parents' house in Cupertino, to bring me a VHS tape of this thing called The X-Files, the pilot. And I was so taken by it. I liked it so much. And I told my sister, this is really fascinating. You need to watch this. And she watched it. And a couple years go by, and she calls me up wanting to compare notes on The X-Files. And I said, the what? And she said, The X-Files. And I said, I'm not sure I know what that is. She said, you had me watch the pilot. You told me I needed to watch this. And I said, oh, right, you need to watch that. Yeah, so is it worth me getting into? And already back then, I was terrified of getting pot committed to something that was going to get canceled.
No.
Right?
And you think, yes.
And so then, of course, my sister catches me up and you know, I binge watch. It might have been after the first season, honestly. It might not have been the second season. It might have been when a second season was insured. But as you know, that wasn't clear for a long time that it was going to continue. But But I got that same feeling here. Not that my sister should watch from here on in without me, but that it's really on to something. But that it also might just be the show that we need. And what I mean by that is, right, the X-Files on two fronts. It had a female-male working dynamic that in the early 90s we needed to see.
Right. Refreshing, respected each other for their differences
And their differences were opposite the grain from where you might expect them to be at the outset. That's what was also fascinating. But also its grit and its, I don't know if cynicism is too strong a word, but its healthy dose of cynicism, let's say, was something the 90s really needed coming on the heels of the 80s. And,
right. And the 90210s and all of that chatter in the day.
Yeah. So this show, I have many of the same stirrings. Like, okay, this is interesting. The male-female working relationship in here, again, worth resetting in the wake of the Me Too. Mm-hmm. And what these characters embody is nothing less to me than kindness. In the wake of even bad things being done to them, manipulations, attacks, fear, their innate kindness rings through. And that might just be what we need. And when you combine it with this exploration into the mystery, that's changing the game in some subtle yet potentially significant ways.
Yeah, I'll say. How about that? You never think of kindness, particularly if a show is called Evil. Who would think kindness is
overreaching art? It's from the married couple, the Kings, who created The Good Wife. It stars Katja Herbers, who played Emily in Westworld, the daughter of Ed Harris's character. And was terrific in it. Just fantastic. I mean, when I saw her in that, I went, this is great casting for someone to play Ed Harris's daughter. Because you got to have some gravitas to go toe-to-toe with that guy.
That's true.
It also stars Mike Coulter, who played Luke Cage on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
And Asif Manvi is the third member of the team. Asif Manvi from The Daily Show.
He's funny.
And he could not be playing it more dry. He's the smart one, and he's still funny as a result. But it's a humor utterly rooted and grounded. If anything, yes, you're our comic relief, but we're grounding our comic relief in the guy that gets the job done.
Ah. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, honestly.
As opposed to bumbling.
A little bit like grounding the comic relief in The Lone Gunman. I mean, who did we go to for answers?
Right. That's true.
But the gunman. And then the fourth regular of the show is Michael Emerson, who won Emmys for Lost and who is wonderfully creepy is his stock in trade. In fact, this story I may have shared before. I'm sure I must have shared it on this show, but only once. So why not repeat it? When I was, and it's the second callback to Karl Rove, I Love You of the show. But back when we show Karl Rove, I Love You in New York City, and we had a turnaway audience, so we had a second by popular demand screening, and. Mm-hmm. And it was a much smaller crowd. It was announced. It was the next day. It was during the day. And it was a wonderful Q&A afterwards, or at least that's what I'm told by the other participants in it. All I was aware of the whole time was how much someone in the audience was creeping me out, staring at me in a way that was making me really uncomfortable. And then when the Q&A was over, this gentleman was trying to track me down, was trying to get up and talk to me, and I had to keep moving around to keep people between us before finally rushing out before he could speak to me. I didn't know why. It was just my fight or flight instinct was on full, and I knew this person meant me harm. And that was all she wrote until I think like a month later when we're showing the film as part of Outfest here in L.A. I go to a screening of another film, one of their opening night films, I think. And yeah. Damn if that guy who creeped me out so much isn't one of the stars of that movie. It's Michael Emerson. And I go, oh, for God's sakes. The whole reason I was freaked out by him was I was seeing the guy from that Brady Bunch episode of The X-Files in my
life. You're hilarious. You're freaked out by the character. Well, that just means he's a very good actor.
Yeah. Well, it means both. I'm glad you pointed out both. It means I'm hilarious and he's a great actor who really created an indelible character that was real to me and that planted itself in my consciousness.
Yeah. So the hats off to that feller is what I'm saying.
All right. Before we leave the small screen in the world of television, I want to get your take on Saturday Night Live's firing of a comedian, Shane Gillis. Yeah. Days after announcing he joined the cast in the first place.
Yes, I think he now holds the record on the shortest length of time a cast member's had, 4 days.
So due to a slew of racist, homophobic, and misogynistic comments the comedian made during several different podcast appearances over the years, but it was especially in the wake of some Asian jokes, inappropriate Asian jokes, racial slurs, directed towards presidential candidate Andrew Yang. Yang Gang. What are your thoughts about this, Dean?
Well, you know, normally I'm like, you're holding people accountable to tweets and things they said long ago when they were less educated and now perhaps they're more enlightened. But the fact that the one was from September 2018 would suggest that he is carrying these retrograde ideas and joke material. So I could not support him and agreed that the firing was justified. Go ahead.
The reason I ask is because there's been a lot of kind of pushback on how far woke culture has gone. You know,
the cancel culture, as they call it.
The cancel culture, the PC police. And especially because Andrew Yang himself forgave him and said he shouldn't be fired. And if Andrew Yang could say that, why are so many white people demanding that he's fired? And I get that pushback against cancel culture, against wokeness, against PC, holding what people did in their past forever over their heads as reasons they can't have jobs, that they can't evolve, they can't grow, not cool. And indeed, you hope that this guy might learn a lesson now. But my two points are, one, this is a business, and Saturday Night Live made the right business decision.
Yeah,
to get rid of this guy now, because do we think if he achieves success, and with that success a certain amount of power and authority, mm-hmm. then he's going to become more thoughtful, or he's going to become more of a loose cannon?
Right, and he's going to go, well, everybody knew about that, and I'm successful, perhaps because of it, because of that extra publicity. You know, the old adage of there's no such thing as bad publicity. Then does that exacerbate it? Does he then use that? Does he continue that rant and that angle for the rest of his comedy career? which would be terrible if that was the case. So,
but if he does, if he does now, that's fine. But he's not doing it on a on
larger platform,
on a corporate brand. Yeah,
yeah.
That is so reliant on advertisers and things, and also, you know, they're in a tricky situation where, you know, you want to be able to keep comedically holding those in power accountable through mm-hmm. your brands of sketch comedy. And therefore you have to be very specific about where you're picking your battles, where you're willing to wade into controversy, where you're willing to suffer the slings and arrows, and not be looking over your shoulder, wondering where we're unexpectedly going to get that because an idiot can't keep his mouth shut or speak with some level of understanding and compassion. And like I said, it's going to be harder to do that if he's a breakout star. So best, right. You know, it's canary in a coal mine time from a corporate perspective. So that's one. The other thing about it is this idea that it should be okay, we should forgive him because Andrew Yang forgave him. That means that it should be up to the victim, if we can call him a victim, but the recipient of this behavior to mm-hmm. be the arbiter of whether that behavior is okay or not. Yeah, that's worked great for, African Americans for 150 years in this country, right?
Right.
They will point out that what that person is doing is racist. They will point out that what these cops are doing is murder. They will point these things out, that what this group is doing is denying their basic civil rights. They point those things out. Society quickly responds to it, adjusts, fixes the problem, moves on, and we have become a more perfect union. Oh, wait. No,
oh, wait.
That's right. No, the majority has always decided, the very white majority has always decided what is just and equitable in these situations. And
right.
Now we want to absolve ourselves of that by saying, well, see, they said it was okay. This is like saying, in the Polanski case, for example, well, you know, the girl who he raped has forgiven him. So why can't we?
Right.
Well, the reason might be because if he's not held accountable, he may just do it again.
Right.
And then we find out Polanski's done it again and again and again.
Right. And or then it allows other people to go, well, if Polanski got away with it, it's fine. And I will be forgiven by the young woman years from now. So there's no recompense whatsoever to not do it.
Yeah, we need to hold people accountable, and that's what it's about. And it shouldn't be up to the people who are on the receiving end, right? I mean,
yeah.
If there are if you witness, what's the Homeland Security thing? If you see something, say something.
Right.
But that's it, you know. Take up the side of the little guy, for crying out loud. Not as a way of cancel culture, but as a way of saying, hey, brother, we can do better. We need to do better, right?
Right, exactly.
And so, anyway, that's what those are the two things to me that it's about. All right, hey, let's do the long-awaited return of a segment that we have not been able to do for a long time because, you know, I darn near went blind.
Oh, yeah, right.
But now I'm back, and I'm reading books, and I want everyone to find out what we're reading. What we're reading. And, of course, what we're reading is brought to you by the good folks at Booksmith Quality Used Books, the proprietor of which is a big friend of this show, Stephen Fowler. And you have news about Stephen Fowler, don't you, Dean?
I do. Holy smokes. We wish him well on his recovery of his three stitches in his leg that he got from a knife from a crazy, crazy woman who was stabbing people right in downtown Nelson there at the corner of Baker and Stanley around 5:20 p.m. on September 19th. There is a very detailed account of him saving, being the Good Samaritan and stopping a stabbing death because he tackled the knife-wielding woman without regard to his own safety. And you can read all about it in Penticton News, Penticton Western News, I believe is the actual website. And my gosh, we wish him well in his recovery and salute him for jumping in without a nary moment's notice or even a thought to himself. Him and another guy grabbed the woman from behind, wrestled the knife out of her hand, and pinned her down till the police came.
Very, very, very short woman, apparently. Stabbing him in the leg.
She was waving the knife wildly. It wasn't that she was so short, you know, that it was leg height. But
or
no.
Or it was a very long knife. I mean, it was...
yeah, right?
It was a sword, really. It was a broadsword. So. Look, I'm making light of it because we know he's going to be okay. And, you know, and we wish him well. Good friend of the show. Do you have the Citizen app, Dean?
Do I have the Citizen app? I do not. Tell me all about the Citizen app.
Okay, it will give you crime alerts in your area. You know, and I mean it's a little spooky, but it's the good one. It's a good one to have, like, because it can let you know in advance what's going on before you go out into the world. Like, so anyway, it's the Citizen app. And anyway, I just felt like a Good Samaritan might just be a new episodic series available for streaming on the Citizen app.
Ah, the Good Samaritan. Look at that. That's nothing.
So, all right. So what are you... I think what Stephen Fowler would have wanted if he...
No, he's alive.
Oh, okay. All right. What he would have wanted is for us to go on with what we're reading. So, Dean, what have you been reading?
Well, you know, I got back into being inspired by graphic novels. So I'm rereading Alan Moore's The Watchmen, of course. I believe Pulitzer Prize winning graphic novel or Booker Prize. One of the first graphic novels to win the big literary awards. Rereading that. And of course, I was handed a pile of new comic books. So I'm afraid I'm in the comic book lore in reading Batman and the Curse of the White Knight. And, of course, the other IDW, Batman and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles IDW crossover. So
wherein we learn that the Lone Gunmen are still alive.
No, that was the IDW X-Files, Lone Gunmen, Ghostbusters, The Crow, and... Mutant Turtles, all in a Lone Gunman story.
Well, agree to disagree. Anyway, so The Watchmen, it brings to mind a couple of thoughts. First of all, is it an HBO series that's coming?
Yes, I think so. If I'm not mistaken. HBO. And I'm pretty sure.
Are you excited about that? Are you looking forward to that? Or
I think so. You know, this I guess the re-envisioning of superheroes as human flawed humans is now not as groundbreaking as it was in the 90s. So it'll be interesting to see the tropes re-examined, reworked, as it were, now that every superhero movie has something, a nod of its hat to what The Watchmen laid out originally. So I'll be curious to see how they do it in this day and age of capes and tights movies, you know?
Well, the opportunity for world building as allegory, it strikes me, is, you know, hopefully what they're going after here.
Yeah,
that this could be a wonderful allegorical piece. Do I think they'll pull it off? No, because there's nobody alive who's doing allegory. Anyway, enough said with that. The other thing is, hey, did your I don't know. I'm going to say your comic book museum ever get completed?
My comic book museum, which entire collection of everything alphabetically ordered in bookshelves across the entire house, that thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it finally got completed. It was arduous, but the $14 app that cataloged everything and categorized all the rare comic books has now come in very handy in finding key titles. So it's all working out.
And I'm sure there's a couple of streaming series available on that app. Okay. So I am reading, thank you for asking.
I am asking.
A memoir by a friend of mine who is, like myself, a longtime contributor to the Midweek Drive on Siren FM. And it is a memoir, don't you know?
I love that
a memoir. And that's even in the title. Where Have I Been All My Life? A memoir by Annette Andre. And Annette, a delightful actress, appeared in so many shows that I loved, when I was a kid and growing up. The Prisoner, Danger Man, The Saint, The Persuaders.
Right.
So anything with McGoohan and Roger Moore in it. It's a delightful read. She's a wonderful writer, a wonderful lady. What is just both compelling and shocking and sad is that a lot of the book, it could be titled Men Behaving Badly. You know, like her telling so many stories about, you know, her coming of age in the industry and pursuing acting. And dear God, it never a pursuit for the faint of heart, as we know. And just what our female colleagues have had to put up with. There's one turning point she talks about early on in the book is being in a play where her co-star increasingly felt the need to rely on the bottle to energize his performance and get him where he needed to go. And so he could muster the rage and the violence. And sure enough, one performance that manifested in full on punching her in the face.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
And this after ongoing complaints of hers fell on deaf ears. You know, no one having the back of these performers, and especially female performers. And of course, it being so tough because a man stands his ground. He's a professional. A woman stands her ground. She's difficult, right?
Right.
Another one of these rage-filled men depicted in the book, Patrick McGoohan.
What?
Yeah, it is chilling, the scenes she describes, what she describes on the set of the Prisoner and some of the behind-the-scenes that she peels back the cover on, the lid on, including him constantly firing directors after they've shot the episode, just being on them the whole time and just filled with anger and rage. And now the thing is,
does this coincide with your, you knew him, you talked to him.
So it's a yes. And I know this side of him very, very well. And, it makes sense given the character that he was playing, that this is what's coming forward. And I guess the challenge is there's no other creative heavyweight on that show that can counterbalance it.
Right.
But you know how, like, you would say, stories about how Daniel Day-Lewis, depending sometimes on characters he's playing, he's going to go so into the characters that he'll give the crew notes and gifts beforehand saying, I apologize in advance for my behavior.
Right.
And it's not that he's going to be, cruel or torturous to them, but he's going to might be aloof or unavailable.
So, really in depth into his own work process.
Taken by, and this is true, no matter how much you think it isn't true, you're going to be taken by the energy of the characters you play. If you're making a film about certain energies and you're working on that film to a degree, you're going to be taken by those energies. That's just the way it works. This is ritualistic magic, people. We are calling energies into being. And but, I mean, this is very much, he's playing a caged animal in this piece. McGowan in The Prisoner, and so it's not shocking to me that that would seep out all around. And the guy, I certainly saw the Patrick McGowan that was the asshole that has burnt who burnt so many bridges. How does a, how does somebody that brilliant and that famous and successful kind of go on to so little later in his career, because it took a very special type of personality to want to work with him again.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it?
There are some stories, like one of the things that angers her so much is his refusal to look at her during a scene, and it really drove her nuts, and finally she lashes out at him, and he lashes back, "Are you trying to teach me how to act?" And And it's really all about context, because it fuels her performance. Her performance is great in this episode that she, by her own admission, never understood. She never understood the plot to this episode. It's a Prisoner episode, for crying out loud, right? Understanding it might not even be the point, but that can be very difficult for a performer. But she finds it. I mean, it is. She's primal. She's just spectacular in it. She matches him toe to toe, which you can tell that McGowan the performer really enjoys Annette Andre the performer, even if it wasn't reciprocated. And yet, you know, so much of the key to McGowan's brilliance as an actor was that he understood pays to watch people be polite. We don't want to watch polite actors.
Well, that's true to a degree, but it's a craft. So, I mean, you could bring that on in your craft, but does that have to bleed over into your day-to-day dealings with your
But see, the story I'm telling is the other way around. She's letting the day-to-day dealings with him bleed into her analysis of his acting while the camera's rolling.
Oh. She,
right? She's finding it unforgivable that he's being so selfish, not looking at her, not giving her what she needs, not, you know, but what's fascinating is you read the description of the scene as she experienced it, and she's actually describing the point of the scene itself.
Interesting.
But it is absolutely true that it's colored entirely. Now, if he was the gentleman that, say, a Roger Moore was, and he then played the scene this way, her sensitivity is such that I bet she would immediately understand, this is a place that the character is in. He can't bring himself to look at me.
Right.
So that's anyway, different. It's really interesting. But this is also, is it not, the abusive personality type leaves you in the position, leaves the other in the position of having to try to make sense of it.
Yes. Well, that's the thing, isn't it?
Because there's no communication.
Yeah. So you don't know where they're at. You don't know what.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And we're all vulnerable all the time as human beings and as artists and creative people. That's what we're being paid to be, is vulnerable. And that vulnerability, I don't know, can be rewarded in many ways, but one of them is through the sensitivity of our fellow performers to communicate with us.
Right. So There you go.
Anyway, there is also, and I'll just a third story I'll share you with, and then we'll close the show with where this leads us. But she plays Buster Keaton's daughter in Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Ah.
And maybe
on stage.
In
the movie.
In the movie, and and maybe it was this that inspired me to watch The General again. And The General was a movie that I used to watch every year on VHS. I had a VHS of it that I loved. You know, the hiss of the VHS somehow just was so soothing and comforting, you know, with the silent film and the grain of the film. It took some getting used to see a restoration in HD. It took some real getting used to of like, what am I watching? This is not the General. What the hell? My God, we've talked about it before. It's been written before, but so modern, Buster Keaton, modern as both a filmmaker in his approach and as an actor. Just
right.
He's contemporary, for crying out loud.
Yeah, feels really contemporary. And I also, you know, was discussing this with Maddie Giles, actually. And for my mind, it's his body movement and the way he moves is very similar to the way we see modern dance in a lot of rock videos now, you know, in terms of the where the gravity is, how he is grounded. And at the same time, you know, he can almost do break dance like moves, but in telling the comedic story. To my mind, it's his physicality that seems so modern.
I love now that I get to say it's not rocket science. It is
modern dance.
It is modern dance. It's a rock video. It's not rocket science. It's a rock video. All right. You know, if people haven't seen it, they ought to see this. I mean, it's just so delightful. 80 minutes of just sheer exuberance. I don't remember whether I know we had it on our list. We did so many top 10 shows, but I don't remember, was it on our best war film list? Because it could have been. Was it on our best comedy list? It could have been. Was it on our best action film list?
Right.
It could have been. It's one of the best of all of these. Orson Welles, you know, said that it was the greatest comedy ever made and maybe the greatest film ever made. But two elements of it, Dean, that I want to chat with you about before we go, before we sign off. One is I learned that the book upon which it's based actually has a hero who is a Union soldier. And Buster Keaton said that, you know, we need to flip it so that it's a Confederate hero or no one will root for him.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting? Because nowadays, I don't think you'd have a Confederate hero.
No.
No. In our woke culture, I don't think you would. But I guess it was this case of only 50 years, you know, 60 years, I guess it was, 60 years after the end of the Civil War, it was still a raw subject south of the Mason-Dixon line.
And yeah, for sure.
So you wanted to have a Confederate hero so that people south of the Mason-Dixon would go to see it. And I guess the belief was that for the rest of the country, especially the Union, they'd gotten over it, as winners tend to do.
Right.
And also the thought that Buster Keaton himself was enough of a draw that it wouldn't matter who he was playing.
Yeah, right. But yeah, that's fascinating. I guess it's also, you know, part of silent film history, Birth of the Nation by D.W. Griffith, whereas also Confederate heroes and Ku Klux Klan heroes. So there was this time in Hollywood history where it was the South that was always propelled as the underdogs, as the ones that are the stories that were told back then. So
I feel like more than anything we've discussed, it's this thematic excursion that is going to inspire Maurice Terenzio to write us this week. I don't know why. That's where I'm placing my money this week. So maybe because of a Confederate hero, I don't know, but probably owing more to the $800,000 budget, which was just an enormous amount of money. After I think the original budget was $400,000 to $500,000, so went well over budget. Understandable. I mean, he's buying actual historic trains and crashing them.
Crashing them on a bridge.
Buying
on fire.
Buying Civil War cannons and cannonballs and firing them off. It's not a financial success. It was considered a flop. Failure. It was a failure. And what do I mean when I say that it was a failure? Well, in part, I mean because of its box office performance or lack thereof, Buster Keaton would never, ever again have any creative authority or autonomy.
That's right. Then all the studios took over his stuff. He had to script it all carefully. So that they could define a budget and keep costs down, which in all the biographies said thwarted him creatively.
And so it is, from his perspective, no doubt, in that regard, easy to see as a failure. From the perspective of the bottom line of the studios, it was a failure. From the perspective of history, maybe the greatest film ever made. Maybe the greatest comedy ever made. A film that belongs on the top 10 best war films, best comedies, best action films. So be careful what you categorize a failure. And most importantly, how you feel about yourself when something you do gets categorized as a failure. This is another chapter in our what might be an ongoing analysis of the meaning of failure following last week's Paul Williams discussion of Phantom of the Paradise.
Right? Best movie ever made.
His whole contemporary existence in show business that he's enjoying. So many of his most fertile collaborations of the past handful of years are because of that quote-unquote failure he made decades earlier.
Right. Amazing.
Amazing.
There's hope for us all.
Yeah, there's hope. And how many people were inspired to make movies or to become Civil War train engineers? By watching The General. We'll never know.
That number is incalculable.
But I do know that my life would be in some way diminished if I had not been able to have all those wonderful afternoons of saying to myself, it's raining outside. I'm going to put on The General.
It's raining here. In fact, I might go watch The General myself.
Dean Haglund, that brings us to an end of another installment. Tortured, a little bit difficult for us to put together. We've had technical problems hopefully no one will ever know about. But they can find this installment and so many episodes at chillpackhollywood.com. They can download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review on iTunes. That's fun.
They can write us, as Maurice Terenzio is doing right now, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Right. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
And finally, if you're within the sound of my voice and you're going to be in Los Angeles this week, come and see me on stage at Leif Erikson Day 1953. Yes, it's set in 1953. We're celebrating Leif Erikson Day, the traditional way. Get your tickets on EncoreSundays.eventbrite.com. Anything you want to plug real quick, Dean?
October 31st, I'll be at Go Comedy in Detroit in Ferndale on Nine Mile Road. come and get your tickets at Go Comedy something.
That's your improv X-Files show. And what about a Gravity Hole? When can we expect another Gravity Hole?
Oh, Gravity Hole. Yes, we're starting up again this Sunday. Sunday will be the next live Gravity Hole, which will be streaming on numerous platforms, including YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, and Twitter. And check it out at gravityhole.com.
We will post it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.